A historic site is now the rope in a political tug of war. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Coconut Grove Playhouse has remained empty for years. There is a plan to restore part of it, but there are people who want to see the entire thing restored. We'll be talking with Miami Mayor Francis Suarez, who'll share his ideas for what should happen to the historic Coconut Grove site. Also, South Florida remains a hotspot for entrepreneurs. There's a startup culture brewing in Broward County. We'll meet one of the people leading that community and one of the companies that's found great success there. They'll also tell us about a conference that's focused on the mistakes that entrepreneurs need to make to succeed. And could you spot an invasive plant if you had to? Florida spends millions annually trying to get rid of invasive plants. We're going to learn how that money has been spent and how you can spot those plants that don't belong here. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, the Coconut Grove Playhouse is at the center of a political struggle between the city and the county. This is a building that's been shuttered for years, but different groups have been struggling over what to do next. Should it be completely renovated or maybe just part of it? Well, earlier this month, the City Commission voted on a plan pushed by County Mayor Carlos Jimenez that would renovate the front of the building and get rid of the auditorium in the back. A lot of people are not happy with that decision. Miami Mayor Francis Suarez vetoed a vote, and it may become a legal battle soon. And we're going to be joined by Mayor Suarez here in just a moment, but we'd love to know from you, your thoughts, what should happen to the Coconut Grove Playhouse. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Should it be renovated completely or just part of it? Again, find us on Facebook or on Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Let us know your thoughts. We've been hearing from some of you, and we want to know more about what should happen to the Playhouse. Again, we're going to bring in Mayor Francis Suarez here in a moment. And just a reminder that there was a vote not too long ago with the City Commission to move forward with a plan by the county that would, again, renovate part of the building. And it would basically remove, destroy the auditorium in the back. But that plan, again, supported by Mayor Carlos Jimenez, was vetoed by Mayor Francis Suarez. We're going to bring him on in just a moment here and ask him why he decided to make that veto and what's the next step. What happens now? Is it going to be battled out in the courts? Again, we want to hear your thoughts. What should happen to the Coconut Grove Playhouse? We're going to go now to Mayor Francis Suarez. We believe that we have him on the phone. Let's see here. Francis Suarez.
I'm here.
There he is. Okay, Mayor Suarez, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate your time today.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
All right. Why did you veto the commission's vote to go forward with the redevelopment plan that was pushed by the county?
The reason why I vetoed it is because I really believe that we have to do our utmost to preserve historic property in the city of Miami. In fact, legally, the standards for demolishing historic property, for obvious reasons, are very high and very difficult. You have to basically prove, if it's state property, which in this case it is, that there is no feasible alternative to demolition. In the case of the city of Miami, the only way you can demo historic property is if either A, it's unsafe, which this property is not, you know, basically it's condemned, or B, you have some sort of economic hardship, which you have to, by affidavit, swear to the economic hardship. And I think what upset me about the whole process is that there were so many things that were being done disingenuously. The county had come forward to the city to talk about its quote-unquote fully funded $23 million plan. When I started to dig into the numbers, what I realized is, number one, it wasn't fully funded. Number two, it wasn't a $23 million plan. It was a $50 million plan, which required $28 million from the city, which is more than the county's own contribution. It wasn't fully funded. And from the county's $22 million, $0 were going to be used to restore the Playhouse. $0. And I think that's disingenuous on multitude of levels. First, you know, you have the 2005 general obligation bond of the county, which had a line item for $15 million to restore the playhouse, and not 1 cent of that $15 million was actually being used to restore the playhouse. So for those reasons and many more, I decided to veto the legislation, and I'm very happy that the commission upheld my veto.
Now, I had read a report that, I mean, look, you and Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez obviously don't see eye to eye on this, but that the two of you had a conversation. Did you?
We did. In fact, I reached out to him the day I issued my veto. I called him before the press conference to give him sort of a heads up. I happened to run into him at an event for the naming of the Wolfson campus for Eduardo Padron. And I told him that, you know, we needed to meet because I felt that it was very easy for us to come to a resolution on this issue. I offered to meet with him and to go directly to the HEP board, the Historic and Environmental Protection Board, and ask the board to give a certificate of appropriateness, which is the approval needed to take certain steps with historic property, so that we could build, number one, the garage, which is something that we, the city of Miami, have the money to do. That's all city money. And so that we can begin to restore the eastern and southern facades of the playhouse, which everyone agrees has historic significance and everyone agrees has architectural significance. So my point to the mayor was, look, let's get started on the things that we agree with right now, and let's get those things going, because you have a 2022 deadline that you have to meet to not be in breach of your lease with the state. And frankly, the state itself and its historic preservation officer wrote a letter to the county basically admonishing the county for its plan, which would be in effect demolishing a historic structure. So they could end up in litigation with the state, which is the land owner, if they decided to go forward with their plan. So they're not only would they be in hot water with the city, but also with the state that owns the property.
And you talk about litigation. Could, because of your veto, and the commission, by the way, couldn't overturn your veto recently, could there be litigation now with the county against you for this?
Well, that's what they're posturing. You know, unfortunately, Mayor Jimenez has been unwilling to compromise and to come to the table to try to find a solution. He feels that the only solution is to continue to fight, to litigate, and take this all the way to the end, unfortunately. I hear you perfectly.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, no, we're here. We're here.
Did you
continue?
Can you?
No, keep continuing. Yeah, we
hear
you.
I'm just saying that, unfortunately, you know, the mayor has taken a position that all he wants to do is continue to fight and litigate rather than to compromise and come to the table. I offered him, in addition to going to the HEP board, I offered him money from our general obligation bond under certain conditions that we would be willing to offer to contribute to the project. But we're already, you know, one of the things that I discovered in this process is that according to his plan, we are the major contributor, not only on the capital side, we're contributing $28 million, but on the operational side, we're supposed to contribute 100% of the profits from our parking garage, which is estimated to be $450,000 a year.
Let me go to this too. Just at this point, I want to know from you, what do you envision? I mean, you talk about what, you know, what the two of you at least agree on, what you can move forward with now. But for you, what's your plan? What do you envision should happen to this facility?
My plan is simple. My plan is that we need to exhaust all remedies before we even consider demolishing a historic property. And we're not anywhere near that. My plan is that we need to start right away working on the things that we do agree on, which, by the way, could have been done by now. The county's been the tenant on this property for 5.5 years without doing one thing. The city of Miami also waived $3 million in code enforcement liens and fines against the property. And the city of Miami contributed money to extinguish liens that were there from outside people. So the city of Miami has done a tremendous amount to try to rescue this property. And the county, unfortunately, rather than wanting to compromise and figure out a way that we restore the building, maybe create an annex for Gable Stage, which they're obviously in partnership with an FIU, so that they can continue to do what they're doing now. And sort of, instead of making this a 66% commercial mall and 20% small theater, why don't we come together to restore the theater, create an annex, and do something that's really going to leave a lasting legacy for our children and preserve one of our few historic nationally, you know, properties on the National Historic Register in our inventory in the city.
Do you think, though, I mean, because I know that, again, that's part of the, some people want to see just the full restoration and that, you know, that there could be lots of theater there. But do you think that financially? Is it viable to have that full theater that you could fill that with shows all the time? We have a lot of options in South Florida right now.
We do have a lot of options, Lewis, and I would tell you that don't talk to me. Don't take my word for it. Take the word of Andy Garcia, who's a world-renowned actor. You know, he will cite, you know, theaters across the United States that are in the 700 and above category. And frankly, the way many people who have testified have said that, you know, a 300-seater may not be economically viable because it's too small. So, there is, I think, a big debate about what is the appropriate size, whether it should be smaller or larger. I think what's great is that there's the envelope of the property is large enough to accommodate both. You can accommodate a small annex theater of 200 seats, and you can fully restore the playhouse at 700 seats. What you can't do is have a mega mall. You know what I mean? You can't have more commercial space and do it all. Obviously, that's just not possible. There's limitations to the size of the property. And frankly, the Grove doesn't really need that. The Grove is an area that's renaissancing. You have five new buildings that have been built in the last couple of years. You have Cocoa Walk that's being renovated. Many of the commercial and restaurants are being renovated right now as we speak. And frankly, what government needs to do is come together, compromise, and get the Playhouse restored and fixed.
What happens next? And do you have any planned conversations with Mayor Jimenez?
I sent a letter yesterday urging the mayor not to litigate, urging the mayor to sit down. I am open, ready, willing, and able at any time to sit down with him and discuss a way forward. But it has to be an honest conversation. He has to stop telling the public that he has a fully funded plan when what he has is a partially funded plan that requires more money from the city than from the county. That's number one. Number two, we got to figure out what are they going to put in operationally as a subsidy. They're already getting $450,000 from the city on day one. What is the county going to do if this has an operational deficit? How are they going to solve that? Number two, let's get started on the things that we agree with. We built a parking garage next to City Hall. It started after I became mayor. I've only been mayor for a year and a half, and that parking garage is almost complete. Let's get that done. That's something that the Grove needs, that all the business owners in the Grove deserve.
Again, talking with Miami Mayor Francis Suarez, we're talking about the future of the Coconut Grove Playhouse, what should happen next. By the way, we have put in a request to Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez to let him share his side of the story. Now, I wanted to move over real quickly before I let you go, Mayor, and talk about soccer.
Yes.
It was announced that the First Tee golf program for youth is being moved. Now, the home had been Mel Reese Golf Course. This is, again, where the Beckham Group wants to build their new stadium. Where's the First Tee program going?
Well, they didn't want to announce that publicly because they're in the final stages of finalizing that deal. What was great about yesterday was that this was our announcement that the team and the First Tee had come together with an agreement to relocate. And this is something that I promised throughout the negotiations of the soccer stadium. And it was a precondition for me because I felt that the First Tee has done great work in our community, great work with children in our community, and that the Luca family, frankly, has done a great job managing our asset, and they deserved a soft landing and an easy transition. And so it was just a happy day for me to be able to follow through on that promise. And I think in the next week or two, hopefully, the First Tee and the DeLucas will announce where they're going to, which is not too far.
So let's talk about the team. So we discussed this not too long ago on the program, and we talked about the fact that they're going to be playing the first couple of years at what was Lockhart Stadium, okay? And, you know, that's up in Fort Lauderdale, near Fort Lauderdale. But that wasn't what was promised. It was promised that they would play in Miami. Where are you in the negotiations right now? How far is this gone?
We, last Thursday, and let me tell you something about Fort Lauderdale. I have to commend them, because what they've been able to accomplish in 2 months is they've been able to do an unsolicited solicitation. They've been able to select them as the winner of that solicitation. They've been able to defeat any legal challenges, and they've been able to demolish Lockhart Stadium, all within the same amount of time that it took us, the city of Miami, to select somebody to negotiate on our behalf.
That doesn't look good for the city. It's 5 years now since Beckham made the announcement.
It doesn't. And let me tell you something. I was with the mayor of Orlando yesterday, and the mayor of Orlando and I were joking because he said that they were given the rights to the team the same year as Miami was, and they've been playing for 5 years, and we haven't. So I think what that should teach us is that, look, if you don't seize an opportunity to do something that's great for your citizens. It's going to be the best sports deal in the history of the United States. No one's been able to demonstrate one better for me. It's voter approved. And now we have the added benefit that the First Tee, which was a wonderful program that was playing out of the asset, has already agreed to move under the conditions that they've agreed to. So there's no obstacles in the way. At this point, we have to finalize the deal and follow through on what our residents have asked us to do.
Okay, so I'm going to try to encapsulate all of this because it is a very complex story. Just real quickly, and I want your take on this.
Sure.
You've got a team that, again, they want to build on Mel Reese, where the Mel Reese Golf Course is. Still have to finish that deal. They do have land, and there was a discussion of buying out the rest of the acreage in Overtown to build the stadium. And again, they're going to be playing for at least the first couple of years in Fort Lauderdale. What's the deal with the Overtown? And again, how confident are you they're going to have this deal set, they're going to be in Mel Reese, and they're going to have the team ready to play within the next couple of years in Miami?
Well, the deal in Overtown is a deal that the current ownership group inherited from the prior ownership group, you know, and I leave that to them in terms of their dealings with the county. They've mentioned publicly that that's sort of a plan B if things didn't happen in Maurice. I feel very confident. I mean, I think when you structure a deal that could bring to the city of Miami, conservatively speaking, with 3% growth in property taxes, $5.6 billion in revenue, zero subsidy, a fully decontaminated site, which is incredibly contaminated, probably the biggest contaminant of the Miami River, a 60-acre park, 23 acres of soccer fields, thousands of jobs at an enhanced living wage of $15 an hour, which is something that was negotiated by the chairman of the commission. I think this is a phenomenal deal for the residents of the city of Miami, and they're giving us $20 million to improve the park and $5 million towards the Baywalk.
And by the way, is that been said, that, you know, because we talk about the decontamination, you're talking about cleaning up that site, that's millions of dollars. How can you guarantee it's not on us?
Because that's going to be part of the lease negotiations that we're doing now. I mean, these were all spoken about and agreed to in anticipation of the referendum. And so at a base minimum, bare minimum, what's going to be incorporated for purposes of negotiation, Lewis, is the things that have already been agreed to. And that's one of the things that have already been agreed to. They're in the final phases of getting their environmental study completed. They've given us indications that there are no surprises, so that it's going to come within what they estimated, which was their top figure was $35 million. That's something that the private sector is going to pay to decontaminate. And I can tell you, just based on some things that I've heard of the contaminants that are in that site, everything but radioactive materials. I mean, it's really, really nasty stuff that's there, and it's stuff that contaminates our groundwater, frankly.
Let me finish with this. You know that stadiums sometimes could be the death knell to a mayor's legacy. And I don't need to even go into Marlins Park. But, I mean, for you as the mayor, how are you making sure that, you know, the soccer team and this stadium and all this deal isn't going to be, it's going to be something that's a plus for your legacy, not, you know, something bad?
Well, it's easy. And I'll tell you why it's so easy. Because none of the stadium deals ever done in South Florida, not one of them, has ever been subject to voter approval. Not one. And this one was. And this one received more than 60% support in all five City of Miami Commission districts. If you poll it today, it's over 70%. And the only reason why it was at 60% was because some people opposed it. And listen, I do not begrudge anyone who feels that it should remain a golf course. You know, I think the beauty of democracy is that we get to debate these things. The owners of the property were the ones that made the final decision. And they decided that they wanted to go in a different direction, create a public park, a 60-acre public park, which is three times larger than the next closest one in our inventory, which is Maurice Ferre Park. And decontaminate a site that is probably one of the worst contaminants to the city of any site that we own in our inventory. So, you know, the residents have spoken. They're the ones that decided to go forward with this deal. That was my best hedge, was to say, you know what, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm, you know, too invested. Let me make sure that as we package this all and put this all together, that my bosses are the ones that have the final say. That never happened when the Dolphins moved. That never happened with the Marlins Stadium. That never happened with the Miami Arena. That's never happened in any sports deal in South Florida. And so that's what gives me confidence that the residents support it.
We've been talking with Miami Mayor Francis Suarez. Again, we talked about the Coconut Grove Playhouse. We also talked about Inter Miami, what's going to happen as the negotiations continue on their soccer stadium. Mayor Suarez, I appreciate your time as always. Thank you.
Always appreciate talking to you, Lewis.
All right. And just as a note, we have also put in a request to hear from Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez and to hear again his take, because he has a very different idea of what should happen to the Coconut Grove Playhouse. We've been hearing from you, by the way. You can find us on Facebook at WLRN Sundial. What should happen to the Playhouse? Bob Diamond from Miami messages on Facebook. He says, we must completely restore this national historical landmark, preserving the theater, installing quality management, and returning this landmark to the revered venue it was is imperative for Miami's cultural footprint. Thank you, Mayor Suarez, for your dedication to seeing this justice played out and upheld. Lisa DeAndrea from Miami messages on Facebook as well. She says, the county's plan will bring great regional theater back to this iconic site and the building. The entire front building is being restored in their plan, and it's an economically feasible plan. I'm all for it. All right, still to come. What does it take to start a new company in South Florida? Do you have a business idea? We're going to look at startup culture in Broward County. That's up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, South Florida continually ranks as one of the best places in the country to start a business. And startups in our region are getting national attention. Fort Lauderdale-based Zendu is a tax prep company. They recently won $100,000 in the Rise of the Rest competition. It's led by former AOL CEO Steve Case. The online accounting and bookkeeping company also won last year's eMERGE Summit competition. So joining us now in studio is Lillian Roberts, CEO of Zendu. Lillian, great to have you. By the way, congratulations on all that.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be here.
Wow. That's a great year right there. Also joining me in studio to discuss the startup ecosystem in Broward is Mark Lissad. He's the executive director of Startup Broward, which regularly hosts events for budding entrepreneurs. They've got an event coming up this weekend in Fort Lauderdale we're going to learn about. Mark, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
All right. You know what, both of you, do you believe South Florida really is one of the best places for startup, and why? What makes us so special? Lillian.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, you're living in paradise, right? And then we were the early tech place because we had IBM. And so we have a ecosystem of the college's talent, 300,000 students, by no state taxes when you're developing businesses and creating wealth. And it's just an amazing place to be. You have the region from Palm Beach to Miami.
All right. So besides the paradise, Mark, besides the nice beaches, the palm trees and the great weather in the winter, what is it? Why?
Diversity. I think this is probably going to be the number one reason, just because of all the different influences. And if you think of a startup, if you think of a business, it's about problem solving. And when you have different people looking at different angles, you're going to have that kind of diversity that's pretty much going to generate a lot of different ideas. And that's what's going on in our ecosystem. That's why we're number one in new startup formation.
Broward County usually is up there top, number one. Miami-Dade really close.
Right. Actually, Miami-Dade is
Number one. Sorry, that's right. Okay.
Right.
Well, you know what? I mean, different things I've read. I mean, Miami-Dade, Broward sometimes are just put together.
Correct.
So, Lillian, what sort of support do you find here, you know, especially when you were starting Zendu?
Well, I'm a native of South Florida, so I've lived here my whole life. And I think that the support that you have here, as Mark said, is the diversity. So we don't have large corporations, not many of them. So you have a lot of people that are creative thinkers and a lot of different businesses. And we're also a hub for travel. So that lends itself to people coming in and having great ideas. And when you have that in a marketplace with the population we have, so easily to get to in the Tri-County area. And you know, Lewis, you mentioned that Miami and Broward, I really look at it as a region. We're the South Florida region, and it doesn't matter if you're in Dade or Broward. We're all together, and we are now taking the country by storm with startups.
Yeah, the South Florida metro region, I mean, you're from Palm Beach County all the way down to the Keys, which is our listening area, by the way. So lots of love to the folks in Palm Beach County. We're not forgetting you as well. But what, you know what, not to paint the picture either, Lillian, that is perfect, what are some of the challenges that you faced when you were starting up?
And we still face it. Look, we're, you know, as I say, we're a scrappy startup that is in the scale stage. And so the challenges are the balance of finding the right people at the right time for the business. And that, I think, is for any business a challenge of how do you balance your growth with the team and building your tech. And that doesn't matter where you are in the country.
Yeah, Mark, what are some of the things that you hear from entrepreneurs about the challenges they face here? I mean, yeah, we have diversity, but...
Well, funding is a challenge, and we have a lot of entrepreneurs that still can't find access to resources that they need to actually grow and scale. That's one of the issues I faced when I was launching my startup, which prompted me to actually go and start Startup Broward. I realized that I was building a rocket without a rent. I was putting a lot of my energy and effort into my startup, but there were no resources available for me to grow it.
Yeah, tell us about, I mean, for your startup, for Startup Broward, I mean, why did you feel there was a need for that?
Well, just a quick example. I pretty much had given up on my startup, but I wanted to go to a conference. It's the TechCrunch conference. And I signed up on Crunchbase. Within a month of signing up, actually within 2 weeks of signing up, I had $200,000 offers. I mean, two separate $100,000 offers. One from the state of Hawaii and one from China. China wanted 20%, so I didn't consider it. So then I realized that it wasn't my startup that was bad or, you know, that was not going to succeed. It's just that the resources are not here yet in Florida where they should be. So
why did you stay in Florida then?
Because
if those resources aren't here.
Because one, I love being in paradise, and two...
Wait a minute, Hawaii is a nice place. Not that I know. You were going to go to Hawaii, I'm just saying. But no, in all fairness, right. Because, you know, that's subjective. People can find paradise in a lot of places, but if that startup, because that's such an important part, is the capital.
Right.
If it's not here, is it about waiting for it to come here, or why not go somewhere else?
Well, it's coming. I mean, there are plenty of articles about how wealthy people are moving to South Florida because of tax climate. But one of the reasons for me to stay in South Florida was because when I did the math, it would have cost me about as much to move there.
Okay.
To actually gain access to that funding. So, you know, I would have been exactly where I started.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is this. I mean, because we always hear about, you know, obviously Silicon Valley and all of the money seems to be there. Do you still feel like you have to be there or anywhere near there to get the capital?
No, actually, I was in Silicon Valley for about a month in February. And, you know, I was looking at their ecosystem. And the thing is, they're pretty much have reached a point where they're looking outside of their own model. And, for example, Steve Case came down. You know, he traveled throughout the United States. So the money is actually flowing to different places. And South Florida is becoming one of the wealthier places where, you know, funding is becoming more available to startups.
Lillian, do you ever find yourself in that position where, because look, I mean, you spent your whole life here, but that maybe you might have to go somewhere else because, you know, the money's not here or the cost of being here might get out of hand at one point.
Actually, there's certain pieces of talent that you do need to get somewhere else. And the world now is, you know, it's local, not in a local sense, but you could be anywhere in the world. So a good part of our development team is in Estonia, which is the Silicon Valley of Europe. We will also add distributed teams for software that will be in Waterloo or Carnegie Mellon, because those are the colleges where those minds are. So we'll go there for that. We believe that we'll always be able to have our base in South Florida, and we want to stay here because we want to bring businesses and startups and hope to South Florida that, yes, you can do it. You don't have to go to New York, Boston, and SF, right, to do that. Mark had a very good point about funding, and that is that the South Florida investors, and I invest in businesses as well as build businesses, and the South Florida investors are used to real estate. And so it's about educating them. It's not that they don't want to invest. They have to understand that it's diversifying their portfolio in a different way. When you invest in real estate, you always know you have something tangible, but you're only going to make a cap 5, a cap 8, right, on your CapEx, right? So when you invest in a startup, in a technology company, you may get a 30-time turn, a 50-time turn, a 100-time turn. So how do we educate the investor community in South Florida? How do we educate the colleges to, instead of sending off our great talent out to outside of the area, how do we get them to help us get that talent?
All right, there are a couple of things you pointed to I wanted to get to. Again, I'm talking with Mark Lissad and Lillian Roberts. Mark is the executive director of Startup Broward, and Lillian Roberts is CEO of Fort Lauderdale-based Zendu. She recently won the Rise of the Rest competition and the Emerge Summit competition. We're talking about startup culture here in South Florida and why this is the best place if you're an entrepreneur to get started. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRNSundown. Love to know your thoughts. Why is it such a great place? Don't tell me it's the palm trees. Tell me, why is this a good place to get going if you're starting a business? So a couple of things that you pointed to. Let's start with this one. The colleges and universities. I'd asked this question earlier of my producers because I work with a lot younger people. I'm wondering, are they teaching entrepreneurship in schools?
Yes.
Okay. What are they doing right and what are they doing wrong in business school right now? Lillian or Mark?
Well, two examples. First of all, I was one of the first graduates of the entrepreneurship program at FAU. And what you're learning in school is a little bit different than the actual startup world. And I'll give you one example. I was talking to this lady yesterday, and she has several masters. And I asked her, do you know what the BMC is? The Business Model Canvas. And, you know, we'll talk about it in a little while. But pretty much, there's a lot of information about innovation entrepreneurship that's not being, told in school. That's not being taught in schools.
Right.
So innovation entrepreneurship is a little bit different than what we think of as traditional entrepreneurship.
Okay. The other thing, too, is, you know, because we talk about what schools can provide and what they're teaching in schools. But the other thing, too, and I come back to it is, yes, this is paradise. But at the same time, and we discuss this on the show a lot, is cost of living here is going up. This is an issue in San Francisco. We're not as bad as that yet.
Yeah.
But it is a tough play. How does that play in? Is that a big problem? You know, especially when you're trying to find talent.
Well, it is. But, you know, again, we're not at the San Francisco level yet. And, you know, finding talent, sometimes you have to find them remotely, like Lillian is doing. But pretty much what we're looking at doing is making sure that the ecosystem can sustain itself. So there is enough income that people can afford to live here.
All right. So we heard from one of our listeners, Michael in Lake Worth Beach. He asked this question. He runs a startup group, but his biggest problem is getting a real estate space to work from and collaborate. Lillian, how much of that is a problem around here? Do you hear that often?
Yes. And actually, I was with David Coddington from Fort Lauderdale today, and we were having the discussion of that. So we're fortunate. We have shared office space upstairs at Extreme Action Park off of 95, and we have our team, which I believe is a phenomenal team in our office. They come from Miami all the way from to Palm Beach, so from PGA to by the airport in Miami. So by us being off of I-95 and Commercial, it's a great place to be. But there's not enough of that shared office space around, and especially as you get further north. There's a lot of it in Miami, General Provision in Fort Lauderdale, where we'll be tonight for the kickoff of startup, is a great co-working space, but we need more of it in Broward. And the other thing that we need in Broward is we don't have scale-up space. So Zendu is at the point right now where we're starting to scale. So with this round of funding that we're closing, we will go from 12 to 13 team members to 60 in a matter of 14 to 16 months. How do we find that space? And how do you find that space that's flexible, that if you're going to sign a 2 or 3 year lease, that you're going to be able to then move from there? So big problem for startups. We need people to develop that. Like Lockhart Stadium would have been great if they made that a startup campus area.
We were just talking about the soccer team, and she went, okay, all right. Well, no, that's an interesting point. They're only going to be there for a couple of years, Lillian, so maybe you can convince them afterward. Mark, before we get to the event that's coming up, for your group, what do you tend to hear from entrepreneurs? What do you tend to hear from people who go to your events about what we heard from Michael when it comes to finding that space?
Well, right now we're getting a lot of co-working spaces like General Provision opening. And actually, General Provision, they have one space and they just opened their new space in downtown. So they're, you know, it's growing, but there's not sufficient space like Lillian was saying. So we need to grow with the demand, and it's not there yet. But
you have this interesting event coming up actually in a couple of weeks, right?
No, actually, it's this Friday.
This Friday. Okay, starting this Friday. It's called Effed Up.
No.
I know. But this is radio, so I'm going to be very careful what I say. This is about stories from entrepreneurs sharing their mistakes.
Well, actually, the event that we have coming is Startup Weekend.
Startup Weekend, okay. But the one I was talking about is in a couple weeks.
Well, it's in a couple months.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for clarifying
that. Absolutely. I think the producer got really excited about that one.
That's okay. Well, no, I'm interested. Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting name, first of all. But it's an interesting concept. So, okay.
Right.
So, again, this weekend you have a different event. In a couple of months, you have one. It's called F'd Up.
Correct.
And it's about mistakes. But that's what I want to get to that because I want to ask you about what are some of the mistakes that you see people are making in today's world? Because one of the other things I pointed out too, I was thinking about is, so a long time ago when you wanted to start a business, you needed a lot of startup cash because you had to have a brick and mortar.
Right.
Where today, not really. If you have a computer, you could just start a business and then grow. But I mean, what are some of the mistakes that you hear?
Well, perfect example. I was talking to this guy and he said to me, I've been working on this businessman for 2 years. And I told him, okay, great. I have one question for you. How do you know that anybody's going to want that product or service that you're developing? You haven't done any market research, okay? You haven't done any product market fit research to find out whether or not your customers are going to want your product. And then he automatically signed up for Startup Weekend immediately because he saw the value in what we're providing. There are different approaches to entrepreneurship, and that's what I was alluding to earlier about innovation entrepreneurship. The worst thing you can do as an innovation entrepreneur is start with a business plan. What you want to start with is a business model canvas.
See, that's so interesting. We're usually taught, have a business plan.
Right.
You're saying, no, that's not where you want
to
start.
Right. Well, we have to make the distinction. Because if you're, for example, doing something, like let's say that you're doing a McDonald's. You're building something that there's a model for it already. There is a playbook for it. All you're doing is applying a process.
Right.
Then, yes, you want a business plan. But when you're looking at innovation entrepreneurship, that's when you're building the businesses of tomorrow. So you probably don't want a business plan because you don't want to be locked in into a model that you don't even know if it's going to work. You spend 6 months. Think of Mark Zuckerberg working like 2 years, and instead of coming up with Facebook, it comes up with a business plan. Okay? You want to put your talent and energy into developing that model, that business model first. Make sure that there are clients. Make sure that there's product market fit, meaning that you interview customers and they really see a need for your product. Then you can work on a business plan.
Lillian, you think about mistakes you've made in your life. What are some of the lessons that you wish you can go back and tell your younger self, but you tell young entrepreneurs, hey, here's something to think about.
Well, one of them, so I've owned multiple businesses. This is the first business that we're taking to scale to larger than 100 million is where we want to go. We actually want to have 25,000 customers across the United States. We today have them in 45 states. Probably the biggest lesson personally was that I was in love with my staff, which I can't help. I'm in love with all my staff whenever I build a team, and I didn't exit a business early enough. So I had an opportunity years ago. I was in print manufacturing and I didn't exit and the world changed and it was disrupted. So when I exited that business, I said the next business I'm doing, I'm going to sit on the other side of the table and what is out there that needs to be modernized or adapted or technology brought to it. And that's why we're in the accounting space. I'm not a CPA. I'm not an accountant. I speak small business language. I love small business and I love helping entrepreneurs help build their businesses. And that's what our team does. And, you know, as I listen to Mark, we have so many businesses from across the country that where we sit, we see what they're doing. And it's the most amazing thing. We have a e-commerce business that sells pocket squares. It's a big business. Who would think?
Pocket squares. I think, no, listen, I don't think everything is digital in this world today. Not yet. You know, I wanted to get this take from both of you. I mean, so our region is, again, it's consistently been up the top when it comes to startup and for entrepreneurs. You know, one of the other big things recently is that Amazon didn't pick us, you know, for their spot. Did that matter? Do we have to have companies like that come down here? It seems like the small business is really better off, or no? You're both shaking your head no.
Do you want Amazon taking all the talent from the area, or do you want all of us startups to be able to build our own teams and to have that? And you know, Lewis, there's one area that we left out as we talk, and that's the work that Mark does in the whole ecosystem of people that are helping the startups in South Florida. And those are people like Emerge America and Knight Foundation.
Yes.
And, you know,
yes.
Everybody, Miami Refresh, CIC.
Mark, real quick, remind us, the event you have this weekend is?
Startup Weekend Fort Lauderdale. Okay. And pretty much you come in with your idea on Friday. You pitch your idea. What we do is we build a team around you of people with complementary skills. You work on the idea the whole weekend. And on Sunday, you have a brand new startup that you can pitch to experts, such as Lillian, that's going to be one of our judges. And throughout the weekend, we're going to have coaches coming in and helping you out, because the whole idea is we want to get you out of your own way. That's why we have the Lifesaver.
We brought the Lifesaver.
The Lifesaver that you're going to sign. And the Lifesaver, pretty much, that's a symbol for us. And
perfect. Well, we're going to make sure we get that information up on social media so people know more about it. Again, we've been talking with Mark Lissad and Lillian Roberts. Mark is the executive director of Startup Broward. Lillian Roberts, CEO of Fort Lauderdale-based Zendu. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Still to come, invasive plant species are an expensive problem in Florida. Do you have some growing in your backyard? We'll have more coming up next on Sundial. Back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Florida has a big problem with invasive species. The state is home to hundreds of them, and many are plants. A new study by the University of Florida and the Nature Conservancy analyzed that the state and federal government spends roughly $45 million a year to combat invasive plants. Is the money well spent? Drew Hyatt, the lead author of the study and research biological scientist at the University of Florida, joins us now. Drew, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Why are invasive species such a problem for biodiversity and Florida's natural landscape?
Well, in general, invasive plants, by definition, are any non-native species that cause ecological or economic harm. Invasive plants usually tend to grow rapidly or spread quickly, crowding out native species, which can degrade habitat for both native plants and native wildlife.
Nice. I mentioned at the beginning there are hundreds of invasive species, and a lot of them are plants. Do we know how many invasive plants there are in the Sunshine State?
It is estimated that there's anywhere between 1,000 and 1,300 non-native invasive plant species in Florida.
So there are hundreds, over 1,000. Wow. You know what? Can you tell us the worst ones, if there's such a thing?
Yeah. So our study, we looked at treatment records for invasive plants in Florida. And the most costly invaders in Florida are the aquatic invader hydrilla. Florida spends approximately $10 million a year managing hydrilla invasions. And then for terrestrial plant species, the tree Melaleuca, approximately $6 million a year is spent managing Melaleuca.
Where are these things coming from?
All over. And it's going to be a continued problem for Florida, and specifically South Florida, where you have climate zones that match up to very diverse areas around the globe. You also have shipping ports that just due to the sheer quantity of imports that come in, it's likely that plant propagules can escape. And because they have similar climates to diverse areas, it's likely when they get here, they'll do very well. And so I think our study kind of highlights that this is a huge problem, and it's going to be a problem for Florida going forward. But we would argue that Florida is kind of at the forefront of combating invasive plants in their natural areas.
I wanted to ask you about the two that you just mentioned. Let's start with, you said hydrilla?
Yes.
All right. So tell us, describe to us what this is and how damaging it is to our system.
Okay. It's an aquatic plant, commonly found throughout north central Florida. In the interconnected waterways. And so if boats aren't cleaned properly, you can have propagules spread between interconnected lakes. And if it's not managed, or if there are cuts in funding that reduce the levels of management that can take place, it can alter the plant communities, but also can affect fishing. Florida is a state that depends very heavily on the health and functioning of its natural resources for continued economic growth in sectors such as recreational fishing. And so by not treating it can really affect both, you know, the avid angler, but also the bottom line for Florida's GDP.
And the other one that you mentioned is a type of tree, right?
Yeah. Melaleuca, very, very common in Southeast Florida. giant tree. They have a couple biocontrols that have been very successful, and that has helped cut down on some of the treatment cost. But it is a very common wetland invader in South Florida. I challenge people to look it up so that they can identify it when they see it.
I'm talking with Drew Hyatt, research biological scientist at the University of Florida. The university and the Nature Conservancy took a look at the millions of dollars that the state and federal government spend a year on Florida to combat invasive plant species. And Hyatt is the lead author of the study. You know what, Drew, for this study, did anything surprise you?
Yeah, a couple things, actually. One of the things we wanted to do was determine or have some idea of why certain counties were allocated more money than others, and if we could get any kind of inference from the data. And one of the more interesting things that we were kind of surprised about was there was a signal from counties that have a high occurrence of federally listed threatened and endangered animals were allocated more money to fight invasive plants, suggesting that Florida is prioritizing managing critical habitat for these threatened and endangered animals, which was surprising and very nice to see.
And what did you see when it came to South Florida, when you look at Palm Beach County, Broward County, Miami-Dade County, and Monroe County?
Yeah, so probably not a shocker. These counties have a high allocation of expenditures. And there's a couple things that can kind of help explain that. One is, like I mentioned earlier, about the similar climates to broad geographic regions around the globe. But also, they have a close proximity to the major shipping ports of Florida, like the Port of Miami. And so they're just going to be constantly inundated with potential invasive propagules that come into the state.
Did the study tell you anything about whether or not the money is being spent well, that we're getting the best bang for our buck?
Yeah. So that was another thing that we put into the model, looking at how money was allocated to different counties. And one of the leading drivers of that was the abundance of invasive plants in that county, which gives us an estimate of management efficacy. But it also tells us something that is very interesting of the importance of identification. So counties that were, spending money to identify invasive plants in their natural areas were more likely to receive funding to fight those invasive plants, which was good to see.
I mean, I could guess, but I'd rather you just tell me as to why Florida is always ranked up there in the top three when it comes to, the number of invasive plants that it's battling.
Yeah, it's right behind Hawaii, and it's just a very unique state that has very broad climatic zones that really match up really well. And again, with the shipping ports and also, very densely populated areas that can have escaped ornamentals, if people have plants that get loose in their backyard, those can cause problems as well. So it's a myriad of different things that can go wrong. But I think in general, state agencies and federal agencies are doing a very good job of combating this problem.
I think about, and this goes back many, many, many years, a teacher that I had in high school who had a great passion for dealing with invasive species, specifically plants, trees, things like that. He basically wanted to destroy them all, and he encouraged us to do the same. But I mean, what do you say to people if they know there's an invasive plant like that? We should point it out to somebody, or should we go ahead and just take it out ourselves?
I think it would depend on the species, but I think the main thing that I would say to someone is to just be informed and be aware. Once that you are aware of invasive plants and what they look like and how to identify the ones in your area, you can generally start to see them kind of creep up in natural areas. And so there are a couple, apps that you can use where you can take pictures and it'll help you identify what they are. And that can actually help scientists to determine, okay, now I can, map the distribution of this plant species because of citizen science. They have detected this invasive plant in this area.
Is there a database, though, so I know where, what I should be looking for?
Yeah, there's two really good ones. One is EDDMAPS.org. That'll help you. Also, there's one called iNaturalist, which will help you identify both native and invasive plants, as well as animals as well. It's very useful.
And real quickly, if I'm a gardener, I'm wondering, how many invasive plants might I have in my own backyard?
Yeah.
Do you hear about that?
Not as much on my end. I generally, in terms of like my occupation here at UF, I kind of focus more on natural areas and detecting invasive plants in more of a natural setting. But I think there's definite utility in people identifying invasive plants, even in their backyard.
Yeah, because I mean, the other thing I was thinking about is, am I buying invasive plants at the store and not even realizing it? Do you think that's happening?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it definitely is an issue going forward that was not really looked at in this study specifically, but I think that is something that people need to be aware of.
This is really fascinating. As you said, you gave us a couple of places to go and check. We'll make sure we post those up so you can go and look to see what the invasive species are so you can spot them yourself. Again, Drew Hyatt, he's the research biological scientist at the University of Florida. This is a fascinating study. Drew, thanks so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that is our program for this Wednesday, May 29th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.